everyone. This is Kyle Draper, and welcome to episode one of Comcast SportsNet's new podcast series, Into the Archives. We have gathered so many great interviews since our station first went on the air in 1981, then as Prism New England. We thought we would share some of these memories with you, the fans. This summer, we will bring you weekly episodes focusing on some of the memorable Celtics-related content we have produced. It is only fitting that we begin with the tandem that has been here since the beginning. Back in 2011, Mike Gorman and Tommy Heinsohn celebrated their 30th year as broadcasting partners. We celebrated this momentous achievement with the television special, focused around a conversation between Mike and Tommy where they discuss it all. Here is Mike Gorman and Tommy Heinsohn starting this podcast with a discussion on how it all started.
Mike.
Tom.
Hey, good to see you. I tell you? After 30 years, we finally met.
That's right. And we're lit so well.
You know, everybody that I run into kind of because of this 30-year thing start asking me, where you came from? Where did you come from?
Dorchester.
Yeah, how did that happen that you got into this business?
Well, I followed you guys as a kid when you were playing, because you're so much older than I am. And in fact, I can remember distinctly selling newspapers, the Record American at Neponset Circle at night, and looking at the box scores, sitting there when I was supposed to be out walking up and down the line of traffic selling papers. I was always looking at your guys' box scores, you and Kuz and all the guys on Sam and Casey. So I was a Celtic fan. As you know, I've told you the story many times. I used to go into the old garden, and we used to climb up the fire escape and bang on the door when we got to the top of the second balcony, and inevitably somebody would come over to see what the banging on the door was. They would open the door of the fire escape, and we'd come in, and by the fourth quarter, in those days, as you remember, the garden wasn't exactly packed, by fourth quarter, we'd be like about 15 rows off the court. We'd just work our way down during the whole game. But after I got out of the Navy, I just wanted to do something different because I had spent a long time. I was almost 6 years in the Navy. So I went down to a radio station in New Bedford, Massachusetts, got a job down there. And when you're in small-time radio, as you know, you do everything. You're not just on air. You sell, you clean up, you close the place at night. And so the general manager down there said, if you can sell it, you can do it. So I went out and I sold New Bedford vocational football, New Bedford High School basketball, University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth basketball, boxing matches in Worcester we sold. So I got a lot of experience firsthand doing play-by-play, going and setting everything up myself and doing it. I don't know if anybody was listening, but I got some pretty good experience doing it. And then moved over to Providence, got a job in Providence, and then you and I hooked up doing Providence College basketball.
Give me a little bit about your basketball background. I know that you're a pretty good player.
Thank you. That's kind of you to say that. I made it through. I spent a year, an ill-advised year at Boston College, and played actually on the freshman team at Boston College when Kuz was the varsity coach. Back in those days, they had freshman teams. But I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to my academics, and Boston College and I parted ways after a year, and I went over to Boston State, and I was going to play basketball again at Boston State because it was Lusky who was coaching at Boston State.
You would have been great in his system.
So, it's great, but I had all these Celtic connections, back then. And Lusky was good, and I worked out and played a little bit for him, and then I just decided that I wasn't good enough, that I wasn't going to play very much, so Lusky had no problem with me leaving the team. So so I left, and but what happened to me was, and back in those days, you used to have a 2S? Whatever the deferment was, if you were in college. Well, when I left BC, I lost my student deferment, and so I was eligible for the draft, and I was about to get drafted, so I enrolled in an officer summer program where you'd go 2 summers to OCS, and then when you get out, you had this long commitment. So I ended up being committed to 5 years in the Navy, and after the 5 years in the Navy, get out and take us back to the original story.
Well, what got you interested in radio? Was it because you were in the Navy?
The Navy was a was a good experience, shall we say. But when I get out of the Navy, I really wanted to do something that I thought was fun. And so I had always dreamed of being somehow connected with basketball. I wanted to be part of a basketball team, you know, I had through most of my high school and early part of college. And so I was trying to figure a way, how can I do it? Well, I'm not good enough to play. I could have gone the teaching coaching route because that was what I had as a background because I went to Boston State Teachers College and ultimately graduated from there. But I just wanted to be around the sport. That's all I knew. I wanted to be around the sport somehow. And so the idea of being a broadcaster sounded like such a great deal. I mean, what better deal could you want? You get paid to go to the game. They give you good seats. And when the game's over, you go home.
Well, you got the opportunity to do Providence College games because you were working in the Providence market. Is that it?
Right. We had done, when I was a PRO, we had done URI radio back when Jack Kraft was the coach down at URI and Sly Williams was their best player. So I did play-by-play of the radio, and that's how I kind of came on Dave Gavitt's radar. And then I moved from the radio station in Providence to the television station in Providence, and that's when I called you. Because we were producing 5 Providence College games a year, I think it was. And I remember distinctly being in a meeting, and they said, well, who we get to do color? And you and Red were doing the Celtic games at the time in Boston, you know, and I loved watching you guys. And I said, well, why don't we see if we can get Tommy Heinsohn to do the color? And they were like, oh, he'd never come down here to do the color. I said, well, you know, you never know unless you ask. We asked. Here we are 30 years later still talking about it. Now, how did you make the transition from coach to broadcaster?
Well, I started broadcasting while I was a player. You know, I was in the life insurance business, so mm-hmm. I used to take every speaking engagement that was available, you know, to meet people and, mm-hmm. and grow my business in a whole bit. And so I would do this on a regular basis, and one day I'm walking down the street in Worcester, and a guy walks up to me, and he says, Tommy, I saw you at the Lions Club luncheon last week, and I heard you speak. He said, you know, I just bought the radio station here, and I'm doing some sports shows. Would you like to go get on the radio? Mm-hmm. And I said, why not?
You know?
And I started doing all kinds of stuff on the radio. Primarily, I would do call-in when I was on the road with the Celtics during the day. And we had, in the summers, I would do interview people. I can remember interviewing the woman that won the Class B hydroplane championship.
Wow.
On Lake Quinsigamond.
And did your homework on that one?
I immediately went to the press room, which there wasn't any, of course. So I had a bone up on hydroplane Class B women's,
right.
Which I knew nothing
That's
about.
Right. No Google in those days.
No, nothing. So I wrote down a series of questions, which you well know is mm-hmm. the worst thing you can do.
Right.
Is write your questions down.
Right. Because then you pay no attention to the answers.
Yeah. You pay no attention to the answers, and the next thing you know, you're off in Neverland. So I start out and I said, well, this is a strange sport for a woman to be in, isn't it? I mean, it's pretty dangerous. And she, no, first of all, I said, hydroplane B. What's the B stand for? She rattled that off. And I said, then it was pretty dangerous and a whole bit. And she proceeds to go on about how 2 weeks before her boat had nosed under and she almost broke her back and a whole bit. In the meantime, like you mentioned, I'm looking at the next question.
Right.
Okay, I'm not listening to what she's saying.
Right.
She almost dies in this thing. So as soon as she stops talking, I said, well, that's great. She looks at me. I'm glad you're all in one piece. I said, I recouped. I had a very nice piece of that. And people came rushing out of the woodwork. That was my first interview, live interview.
Now, this is when you were a player.
I was a player, yeah. And because of that experience, after I retired as a player, Red got the first television contract. And he called me up and he said, Tommy, you've been doing this thing in the radio and you got a little background and you can talk and all this other stuff. He said, we'd like you to do the games, you know, do the play-by-play. I said, well, Red, I've never done anything like that. said, don't worry. He said, we'll get Fred Cusick and Marty Glickman. Marty will come up from New York, and he'll tutor you. And so I said, fine. So went and did this thing. And I did it by myself for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I want to tell you, that was the most difficult thing I ever did. Because you well know, if you're on for the full stint, beginning, the end, the halftime,
yep.
Never got a chance to go to the you know,
anywhere.
Anywhere. And I was dying all the time. So I learned about broadcasting a game, and Johnny Most, I roomed with him on the road, and Johnny was giving me the short course on radio broadcasting. You know, mm-hmm. He was giving me the white hats, dark black hats version of how you do basketball, you mm-hmm. know. And of course, he had been a friend of mine for years as when I was a player. And so in order to listen to the television, to the broadcast, you had to get a loop antenna. You just couldn't get it on a regular right. TV, so right. You had to have a special antenna. Yeah. So there weren't an awful lot of people running out buying loop antennas. So not an awful lot of people were really watching us
right.
on the games.
And what was it, 56?
This was 66.
66?
66, okay. 66. So.
No, see, it was in 1966.
Yeah.
But with Channel 56, is that what it was?
Channel 56.
Okay, right. Because I remember 56 and 38.
Yeah, and they just started.
One was the
out.
Bruins and the other was the Celtics.
Yeah, and the studio was up in on Commonwealth Avenue right near BU, and it was over a dress factory. And every time you go in to do promos, you'd hear the hangers tinkling downstairs, and they were cut. So it would take an hour to do a 30-second promo. Yeah, I listened to Johnny Most. He was giving me the version of black hats, white hats. And mm-hmm. So he said, but don't worry about it, Tommy. I said, well, why not? He says, well, you know, go do your thing. He says, nobody's listening to you anyway. And he was right, because if they had a loop antenna, they would turn us down listening to
listen
to him.
Because
he had the entire audience all the time. He built the sport. But Johnny was... you know, we discussed the philosophies of how to do it, how to be not a homer when you are a homer, and all stuff like that. We had a lot of fun discussing broadcasting. You and I really have never done anything like that. But after, while I was doing it, Red became my color guy. Mm-hmm. And there were some great experiences
with
Red.
That was classic television.
Oh, Red. I mean, my funniest story with Red doing a telecast is we're doing a playoff game in Philadelphia, and big game, and all of a sudden, Red, you'd think I get on the referees. You should have heard him get on the referees. So anyway, we're going on, and he liked to eat peanuts. So he'd be eating peanuts, and during this game, a crucial part of the game, he drops the bag of peanuts on the floor. So he bends down to pick them up, and he loses sight of the court. In the meantime, as he's picking them up, Siegfried goes in and decks somebody from the 76ers, Red pops up, he goes, what are they calling a foul on like that? I can't call a foul on something like that. And... like, I'm trying to get him off the hook. And I said, Red, well, he really did foul him. He said, he wasn't in the play. I said, what do you mean he wasn't in the play? He said, he wasn't in the play. I said, well, how do I get out of this to myself? I said, so, Red, would you say he was in at least the movie? And that's how you have to do with Red to get in and get out. But he never acknowledged that Siegfried ever fouled the guy, and the entire world saw that Siegfried decked him. So we had some great times. And then
Johnny was, by the way, just not to interrupt, but that was one of my biggest fears when I, you know, through the experience I had had with you at Providence College, was able to land the Prism job when we were first doing cable. And I remember there were two people who I was really afraid of meeting. One was Red, and two was Johnny. Because I wasn't sure how Johnny was going to look on this young kid out of Providence who suddenly came in and doing television on the Celtics. And You always sat with Johnny in the press room. So I remember that very first game that we did together in Boston. I had to go in the press room, and I came to the door, and I looked in, and there you are sitting with Johnny, and you go, come on over, you know? And he just couldn't have been a nicer man. Couldn't have been more help. Would always come up to me and ask me how you doing.
Well, he was really looking out for me. He wanted to make sure I had a good partner, because I couldn't survive on my own. See?
I don't know about that. But he was wonderful, and he was so encouraging. And you know, Johnny used to say "bang" after big baskets. And I always remember him saying, like, you got to find something that's yours for baskets, and try out different things, and bring them to me, and let me know. And I remember bringing things, good, score it, whatever, you know. And John was going, no. And that's where "got it" for me came from, because you know, John was like, that's not bad. That would probably work. You know, he was just such an encouraging help to someone who is basically in the same career as him. And you don't find that a lot.
No, Johnny was a great guy. Like I say, I palled around with him for years. He really helped me during that period of time. I was doing the games, which I did for like almost 4 years. Mm-hmm. And because of that experience, Redhead offered me the coaching job even before he gave it to Russell. And he talked to me about it, and I said, I don't think I could coach Russell. And I was in the management end of the life insurance business, and I liked management. So I was in the insurance business doing a broadcasting. And when Russell got the job, and incidentally, I said to Red, you know, I don't know why you're looking for a coach. You ought to make Russell a coach. I said, he's going to motivate himself more than anybody else. And that's what Red did, and he did, because Russell is such a proud person and, a very smart guy.
First game we did together, I believe, was Providence College Holy Cross.
Was it?
On a snowy Saturday night.
Yeah, I don't remember.
I remember
but,
it. Because Jim Edmonds, who to this day is our director on the Celtics, directed that game because he was working with me at Channel 12. But yes, I remember we worked at Holy Cross was the first game I remember. And you had come down a couple of days before to have lunch, and we were supposedly going to talk about how we were going to broadcast the game, and that's when you sold me an insurance policy.
Oh, well. Well, I was in that business for over 40 years.
You know, people don't understand that, you know, because they just assume, especially with the salaries the players make today, that on a commensurate level that you were making that kind of money, and you guys weren't. You guys had to have second jobs.
Well, I'd hate to destroy the illusion, you know, but during the period that I was playing and even coaching, I made more money in the insurance business than I did in basketball.
Right.
Because that's the way it was. But, after doing the games with Red, I knew Russell was going to retire after he made a comment about Chamberlain faking it and not wanting to finish the game out there in L.A. And I knew Russell would never say that unless he was never going to face Chamberlain again, because he truly, you know, was aware of how good Chamberlain was. He didn't want to rile him up, you know,
right.
Calm him down.
Sure.
So I said to Red, well, Red, you know, if you're still interested in me being the coach, I'd think about it. So he talked to me, and you got the job. So that's how I became the coach. And after, you know, enjoying that for almost 9 years, I ran into an owner that didn't think I was doing the job. And I was asked to leave the keys in the door. And off we went. But the good thing was that as they were sending me and discussing my career in various venues on the road on the West Coast, people would come up to me and say, you know, Tommy, you're going to stay with this team? You're going to make it through? I said, well, I don't know. You know, I'm at their disposal. Mm-hmm. I said, but all I know is I got a round trip ticket so I can get back to Boston. And then when I left the Celtics, I started doing games with you. And but I was doing it from a color standpoint, and I had been the play-by-play guy, mm-hmm. so I understood what the role was, mm-hmm. and I had worked for a while before we even met, filling in for Cousy at the station up in Worcester that I was doing college basketball.
No, I didn't know that.
And the guy that owned the radio station that started me owned the television station. So
okay.
I did work for him there. And so I got back into doing color, which I'd never done before. I'd done play-by-play.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you and I end up together. And here we are today.
Here we are.
From doing the games with Mike and doing the games with other people, it was pretty interesting to me that some guys who I worked with would do radio broadcasts on television. So they were creating pictures of what was being already a picture on television. And by doing so, there was a lot of extraneous verbiage so that a color guy could really not get involved. Cousy worked with Gil Santos, who's a fabulous radio guy, does the Patriots and was doing the Celtics, mm-hmm. and then he did them on television. Mm-hmm. And Cousy, because of the way Gil did the games, would wait for Gil to take a deep breath and then would unload the bucket of thoughts that he had. And it
piled
would,
up.
Piled up. You know. So I knew that's not the way I would want to have to do the games. And when you and I got together, I think you understood more than anybody I work with that this is a visual thing. And the other thing is your ego can't match any of the other guys that I really... you're on air, you go, I work with guys that would give you the Heisman, you know, you were talking too much or whatever. And Mike and I, we just go on Mike came, I remember doing the Celtics broadcast, and Mike would show up with all these notes, all these facts, figures about the players.
You said we're not going to need any.
We're not going to need it. You can have it, but Mike now supplies me with the roster of who's playing that night as we sit down to do the broadcast. He makes sure I at least have that. But I don't believe that's my role is to give facts about people. Mike is great at ferreting out the facts. He does the what. The who, and the things that are actually happening at the time they happen, just to record them. And I try and give the why these things are happening. So I wait till he finishes doing the what, and then I come in with the why. And I also try to do it in a clear, concise fashion so I don't over-talk you. Mm-hmm. And allow the picture to the people to reorient to the picture. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I like to do it, and that's the way you like to have it done, so that not stepping on each other. And because of that, we never got into a fight about anything really to speak of. So
no, we haven't, which is remarkable over 30 years, because that's unusual for any relationship to last that long without any kind of blow-ups. But, you know, you taught me very early. I mean, you taught me I could fill 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours with what you've taught me about the game itself. But you taught me from a television point of view not to go in with any preconceived notions, to just go in and let the game take you where the game wants to take you. And that, I think, is what you and I have honed over the years in terms of a style, is that we don't come in with a preconceived notion. We kind of come on the air, we tell you who's going to play and who's not going to play, because you need to know that because of injuries. And then you give a couple of keys as to what you think the Celtics need to do to win the game. And then we sit down and we see whether or not they execute those keys, or maybe they find something else. But we don't go in with any preconceived notions. And I think that's been the best thing for both of us, because we're really fresh every night, in the sense that we're about to like strap in and go where this game takes us, as opposed to trying to force the issue. And both of us have had the good fortune of working on the networks at one time or another, who don't let you do that.
Right.
Who want to have the game all mapped out before the game's even played, which, as silly as it sounds, is the way they want to do it.
I think that the people in the truck that we have Paul Lucy and Jim Edmonds, mm-hmm. who we've worked with for a significant number of years, because I truly believe that these guys are as responsible as anybody for great broadcasts.
Without question.
And the reason they are really good is because I believe that every game is a murder mystery. So that if you're going to pick up this game, the novel, the murder mystery has to be different than it was the last time. So there's, I try to make sure that there's not a sameness to the game that we're presenting and what have you. And what I did over the years when I was doing the games by myself was see that they had basketball 101 television. You know, they had mm-hmm. to have certain shots. They had to have certain ways they cover things. You know, close up, wide angle. It can't be a coach's film. Mm-hmm. It's got to vary the shots and the whole bit. And I was determined to help the game of basketball be seen, the pro game, for what it was, not college basketball that had basketball one-on-one, mm-hmm. 101 type of broadcasting. So I would get together with the producers and the directors and talk about where they could catch action. So I tried to get them to be able to set up clues mm-hmm. for this murder mystery mm-hmm. so that I could talk about it initially and then refer to it as it was happening in other parts of the game. Mm-hmm. All right? And these guys have done it to perfection over the years. And I think that's one of the reasons why we have terrific broadcasts is because we don't do classic basketball 101, and we make it into a murder mystery, and with a little bit of humor too, mm-hmm. because I learned that I got to be a little humorous at times. Yeah. I can get too serious.
And we're very fortunate with Paul and Jim, because you and I are both, again, experienced on a network level. Some directors I even knew on the network level would turn the audio down in the truck. They didn't even want to hear what the announcers were talking about. They just wanted to cut beautiful pictures of what they thought was going on. And we've been blessed to have two guys in the truck who listen to what we say and search for video to match up what we say. And again, having done games on the network level where if what you're talking about agrees with what's on the screen, it's purely by chance. Whereas you and I, you mention a player, you say, oh, he did this, boom, we have a picture of it 2 seconds later. I mention something, boom, we have a picture of it. And so it's much easier for the viewer, because it seems like everybody's on the same page. Often you watch a network game, you're saying like, well, you know, this guy's talking about this, we're seeing pictures of this, and it just gets jumbled. So yeah, we've been very lucky to have very strong people in the truck throughout our career. Jim Edmonds, as I said, has been cutting pitches for you and I since yep. Snowy Nights and Holy Cross, yep. way yep. back when. Yep. Yeah.
This doing it, the Celtics, has really been a pleasure, too. I mean, we've broadcasted great basketball teams, mm-hmm. Very, very competitive teams, with very few exceptions. Met the leading personalities in the game over the years, during the Bird era and mm-hmm. and all the way through to the current era of great players. And watch the thing that I try to convey, even when they were not playing well, was the fact that these people, even though they're not the greatest, and in those years, mm-hmm. they were very competitive. They were doing the best they could, and that the organization was drafting people. And I try to show how they grow as players, even from a year to year and from game to game. Mm-hmm. So we have kind of got a style of where we're Celtic broadcasters.
That's right.
Because we're letting the people who are interested in the NBA in the New England area, who now have over the years become Celtic fans, that's who they want to know about. Mm-hmm. I mean, there may be some Dallas Maverick fan up in Caribou, Maine somewhere, but I doubt it. And that's who we're broadcasting to, and it's more fun doing it that way.
Without question. You know that, again, both of us were fortunate enough to have had a chance to do national games where you have to take a different approach and be kind of rooting for both teams, is the way I always tried to do it, working on ESPN. But you know, everybody knows that you and I want the Celtics to basically go 82-0, if at all possible.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully we've been able to do that without, you know, ticking off too many people in the process.
Well, but it would, there have been some historic moments, you know, games that I remember. You know, I've seen so many basketball games in my lifetime. Yeah. I'm not a kid, so I've seen an awful lot of basketball games, and it's tough to remember certain ones. But there are games that we broadcasted. Like the first game I ever really broadcasted from Madison Square Garden, the new Madison Square Garden, I did the first pro basketball broadcast out of there.
No kidding.
Yeah. And as we were about to go on the air, the ceiling fell down.
No kidding.
From panels came down.
Right, is that floor. Right?
So we had an hour and a half wait.
And you had to fill.
And I had to fill for an hour and a half by myself, okay? And I'm going. We cut for commercials every once in a while. And they get somebody for me, you know, because sure. I was running out of whatever.
Yeah.
And that was as memorable a broadcast as winning the championship, trying for an hour and a half to fill. And then, you know, we broadcast a championship, I did anyway, on the network.
But you got on the championship.
Preliminary sure. series were very important, like the Bird shootout with Dominique Wilkins.
I mean, Bird that stealing was, the ball from Isaiah on the pass into
stuff
DJ.
Like that. Yeah. I mean, it just. And Henderson and players like that made great plays,
but when we worked our hardest was when the Celtics weren't very good.
Yeah,
that was the hardest work.
Yeah, I remember coming back and we'd been on the road and out to the West Coast, and I said to Helen, I can't believe this. We're 0 for January. You didn't win a game.
Yeah,
and
wasn't that long ago. Five years ago.
That's right.
4 or 5
and,
years ago.
And they're tough to broadcast. But again, they still had, I mean, Pierce was part of that team. Mm-hmm. And you could see underneath what this guy was made of. If you've been involved in a game, you could tell he's a competitor. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why I like this particular team that we have now, mm-hmm. is that they're all very competitive and they're willing to sit on their egos to win a title.
Mm-hmm. I tell you, at least one game, though, at least once before we're through, I'm going to convince the powers to be at Comcast to have a Tommy cam in the corner of the screen. so people can see you the entire game. Oh. They can see you like box me out on rebound and put your hand over like this.
I become the Heisman.
You let me catch one ball in 30 years and that came our way. Otherwise, you're just like right in front of me for it. So, we need to see that for one game. Till the day I die, I'm going to lobby for that.
Mike and Tommy's formation as the broadcast team for the Boston Celtics in 1981 coincided with the start of the Bird era and three more banners for Boston. Mike talks about how the success of the Celtics helped him make a name for himself in the early going.
Well, I think for me, because I started, I think, in 80-81, for me, it was being accepted by the Boston audience, because I want to say the first 15 years I worked for what we were Prism, and then we were Sports Channel, and then we were Fox, and now we're Comcast. I always worked on a one-year contract, so I had never knew at the end of the year whether or not I was going to be back or not. And I was blessed to have someone like you sitting beside me, but I was also, it's a rule of thumb for broadcasters, if you broadcast a very good team, you have to be really bad for people not to like you. And I was fortunate enough in the first 5-6 years that I was there, the Celtics won 2 or 3 championships and were in the finals another time. So I remember one year, we went 41 games. I think they lost 1 game at home or 2 games at home. So every time I was on, the Celtics were winning, so people were happy. So that really helped me get established with the winning team. You had obviously been established as a Celtic. But it made me a little more easier to be part of the family when it were winning. I wondered if I had ever started in 1990 instead, I might not have made it 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
I might have been gone. Yeah.
Well, what makes broadcasting fun for me is watching competitive people be competitive. And Larry Bird was one of the arch competitors of all time. I mean, this guy was not the most gifted physical athlete but he certainly was one of the smartest that ever played the game, and he used his Indiana wiles to win titles and to really intimidate other players. It was so much fun to watch him outthink people. The broadcast in a game and watching that happen, it was like, wow. And I can remember in one of the broadcasts what I said, and I came up with this as we were doing a game, is he's the Bobby Fischer of basketball. And I said, everybody plays checkers, but he plays chess. Yeah. So he's 2-3 moves ahead of everybody else that's playing the game, and he makes it pay off. So, and guys like McHale and Danny Ainge and Parrish, Dennis Johnson, all competitive people. Pierce was as important a player with the same attitude. And you can remember when he became captain. Mm-hmm. And this was something that probably he never expected to be. And he wanted to fulfill that role to perfection. Mm-hmm. And he started studying management on leadership. Mm-hmm. And you don't often see guys take to tasks like a guy like Paul Pierce did.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And couldn't be more happy for somebody having a ring than Paul Pierce having a ring, because he paid a lot of dues for a long time.
He fits in with the greatest players the Celtics ever had. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's a Hall of Fame player. Mm-hmm. If he isn't, I'll burn the building down.
And you have said, and it's been controversial to some, that if you were looking for last shot time, one guy score points for you, Paul Pierce is right on the top of your list.
Yeah, he's got so many weapons. You don't know what he's going to do. He can shoot threes. He's got the tweener game down. He can work you one-on-one. He's a strong finisher if he can get by you, which he does an awful lot of times.
Makes free throws.
Yeah. I mean, there may be, like Larry Bird didn't have the athletic ability of Paul Pierce. Mm-hmm. And he was a great player, no question about that. But Pierce has more ways to score on a consistent basis, so that when you start to think about him, and if you're a coach, how do I stop this guy? I mean, that's a test.
Beginning in 1957, the Boston Garden was the second home for Tommy. As a player, coach, and broadcaster, he was there for every significant moment in that building.
Well, being involved in playing games at the Boston Garden, to give you a little background, the building was built with sight lines for boxing. It was built by Tex Rickard, who was Jack Dempsey's agent and manager. He was an architect, and he built Madison Square Garden in New York. So people who came to watch basketball on the building for years, a great number of them had poor sight lines, couldn't see half the court. Mm-hmm. But we did it from the overhang. We had the best, the best view of any basketball broadcaster in the entire league at
Without
the time,
yep.
And even to this
today,
day.
If we could get to that overhang again, I'd go tomorrow.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I sat on right over the first balcony. And do you know how and who started broadcasting basketball on the floor?
No.
I'm going to tell you.
All right.
Kurt Gowdy was doing basketball games for both the network and locally here for the Celtics for a few games.
I remember that, yeah.
And part of his contract said that he had to be on camera a certain number of times, so that they could not bring the cameras in those days up to the thing.
Sure.
So to get him on camera.
Him on,
and that's how the trend started, because he was a national guy, and mm-hmm. if he did it, everybody else should do it. And I kept saying, why do we broadcast here? Because we're looking through referees' legs and everything else.
Right. And we had we had a number of vices, you and I, in those days too.
Yeah,
and we could smoke in the overhang.
You got it.
And we could eat peanuts in the overhang.
Absolutely.
And so, that was quite a place. Some of the people behind us eventually lost patience with us.
Yeah, they didn't like us after a while. But going to this new building, it's better for the fans. The fans are better, but the broadcast facilities aren't like they were at the old Garden.
Oh, I mean, they say, and you think that they're just making it up, but it's true. The building would shake when it got really loud, and especially if you were in that little gondola overhang that you were riding in. That thing would seriously start to move.
I got to tell you something. We were preparing for a game, and I was up there a little early, and there was an earthquake up in New Hampshire. All right, mm-hmm. And the building was practically empty, and it started shaking. And I didn't know what it was. You know, I said, this building is shaking because it was
an earthquake in New
Hampshire. An earthquake up in New Hampshire. It wasn't a big one or anything, mm-hmm. You know. Wow.
There were no small earthquakes, though.
Well, it moved something, yeah. But to get from New Hampshire all the way down here, you know, and for the building to shake was pretty impressive.
It was different for me doing those games in the gondola because, A, we just did the home games. And then you and Kuz and you and Red, and ultimately you and Kuz would go out and do the road games. So for me, I would come into the Garden, walk upstairs to the press room, meet you. You and I would have something to eat. Something I'll never forget, the very first game we did, and you took me down to Red's office, and you went in and talked to Red, and I just tried hard not to embarrass myself there. But I remember it was the first time I ever saw Red's office, which was like a museum because he had all his stuff everywhere in the place. But I would come in and do the game, and I would meet you, and we would go up to the gondola and do the game, and then I'd leave and go get my car and I'd drive home. And I would never see the players. So as much fun as it was for me to do those games in the 80s, with all those great teams, I never really knew those guys. And it didn't become not the way I was so sad when Al Jefferson was traded. You know, as we started to do all the games together, you and I started to travel and be on the road with the guys, and now to have the relationships I have with like a Kendrick Perkins and a Paul Pierce and guys on this team.
Well, you got to tell the story of what goes on between you and Paul Pierce before every game.
Well, I don't want to. I help Paul remember who the officials are.
So I want to tell you, I don't know who the officials are, folks. And he knows who the officials are all the time.
No, that's just, I'm just trying to give Paul a little edge. Anything I can do to give an edge.
When you think of watching a Celtics game on TV, the first thing that will pop into the head of most people is Tommy Heinsohn's distinctive voice and commentary. But what is it like to sit next to him?
Tom has been to a million games, but every game he goes to, he gets as into as any game. And every trip is important. It doesn't matter what the score is. That was a big lesson Tom taught me, is that I have, part of my job is I have to give the score, but it's still as important what you do, whether you execute, whether you do the right thing with the ball, whether you do the right thing on the defensive end. And like all great coaches, he only pays attention to the score at the end of the game when you have to see who's winning. Otherwise, he's trying to get people to do what they're supposed to do. So, you know, there are no bad games with Tommy. Every game is important. Every game means something. And, you know, obviously in the greatest scheme, some mean more than others. But there are no meaningless games, I guess would be the best way to put it, when you sit beside Tommy. He's into it from start to finish. He physically gets into it. Like I said, Paul's got the tape of this somewhere, where I actually did catch a ball. And I was so excited. It was the first time in 30 years. It happened like this year. The first time you didn't elbow me out of the way when the ball came flying towards us on the court to get it. It is a physical and emotional experience sitting next to this guy. I do recall, I don't want to embarrass you here, but I do recall one time we had to physically kind of prevent you from going after a referee in the tunnel.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I do remember that.
And he was an out-and-out jerk. I don't even remember his name now. Do you remember who it was?
Yeah, I do.
Who was it?
We don't want to embarrass him like that. But yes, I remember.
He's since retired.
Yes, I do remember, though, physically having to get between you and he in the tunnel and security people coming and. Yeah, I don't know why I get in between you, because actually I've always wanted to see you go after somebody.
You know, people over the years have criticized me big time because they think I use poor officiating as an excuse when the Celtics lose. And that's not what I'm really concerned with, is whether they lose or not. But there's a certain balance to the game. And if you, for instance, if there are two really good teams and you can't really pick which one is better, it boils down to an out-of-bounds ball, an extra possession. Mm-hmm. So if they call bad out-of-bounds plays where they miscall a possession, one team getting it when they shouldn't, it impacts the game. Now, the average fan perhaps doesn't realize that, but I do because I've been involved in the game for so many years. And also when the three teams, the two teams and a team of officials all impact the game. So we talk about the players. Why not talk about the officials who impact the game? Now, I'm not the only one. After last year's playoffs and after the previous season, I mean, people started criticizing left and right. And right now, they're in the process of breaking in new guys. I know it's not an easy job, but when it becomes subjective, when I feel calls are being made subjectively instead of objectively, I get upset.
Sitting next to him and getting elbowed is one thing, but is there a way to calm him down following a call he politely disagrees with?
I don't know whether I really have any specific strategies. Give the score, give the time. Just try to let there be a little space. Between. The thing is, you know, that I get really upset with people when they say that this is some sort of act, because it's not an act. If you were sitting there with me, you know how much this guy cares about the Celtics, number one, but number 1A, the game itself, and that the game itself be played properly and be officiated properly. So it is not some act. It is not some shtick that Tommy has said, like, gee, I think I'll be the guy who's on the officials. He doesn't have any control of it. Believe me, it happens. It is a reaction to what he sees as a wrong that has been committed, and it comes from deep inside here somewhere. And so I just try to look in a different area.
You know, the reason it impacts me is because of what I just said, the three teams that are involved in a game. But the officials could make it so much easier for themselves, but everybody makes mistakes. And I know when I was a player and when I was a coach, and I'd get on somebody and they'd say, I blew it. I turn around and walk away because everybody's entitled to make a mistake. But all of a sudden, they get right in your face and they're saying that, you know, and then it becomes, what, are you kidding me? And some of the players right now are getting called for technicals for stuff just looking at the officials because they believe it's a terrible call. And they absolutely are wringing emotion out of the way the players play the game. Mm-hmm. By what they're doing right now. And that's an injustice to the fan and an injustice to the game itself.
Besides the relationship Tommy has had with the officials, he is also known to love gritty players diving all over the floor. Back in 2002, Tommy came up with a signature phrase that went viral before the days when things went viral.
Okay, did you ever think Tommy points would become what they are? The people coming up bringing signs?
No, you remember when it happened, because we have production meetings every morning before the game when we're on the road. And one day, Paul Lucy, our producer, said, Tommy, can you come up with an idea that they could deal with the sales force that could sell it? And it was a promotional deal. And by actual fact, why I came up with this Tommy point thing is because I learned from Red Auerbach, and I learned from my own experience, that there are a number of players that play in a game that people don't really recognize how impactful they were on the game. Most of the press does it the easy way. They pick up the stat sheet, and they look to see who won who scored the most points, who got the most rebounds, who did the most assists, and that's it. And they become the stars of that particular game. And I try to spread the knowledge and affection. I call it spreading the love, all right? That people appreciate that a guy came in and played 10 minutes and really fulfilled his role to perfection. This is like rewarding a character actor in a television series, giving him an Emmy for a supporting role. And sometimes the stars get it, and sometimes a guy who's only played 10 minutes gets it. So it's not about who they're going to read about the next day. It's who I think gave the most, sacrificed the most, fulfilled their role the most, energized the game, any number of different criteria. It's not by what I see on a stat sheet.
You got to feel good, though, when you look up into the crowd and you see 7-8-year-olds all the way to 70 or 80-year-olds holding up signs going, "Can I get a Tommy point?" That's pretty cool.
The funniest thing to me is we used to give out Tommy points for all redheads because in honor of my deceased wife, and because she was a redhead. And then we started giving Tommy points out because people would hold the signs up and I came from Canada to see the game, which is extraordinary. Yeah. So extraordinary things the fans did. Then one day we get we put on camera a girl holding up a sign, said, "I need a Tommy point so I can get a date to go to the prom." And I said, "I absolutely have to give that girl a Tommy point." Well, when I did it, somebody must have taped it for her, I don't know. And the next thing I know, 3 weeks later, she's got a sign and she's there with her father and they hold up a sign and, "Thank you for the Tommy point, I got the date for the prom." So the next season, her father and the girl bring the date and introduce me to the date that she went to the prom with. So, I mean, it's like crazy.
You could be the best man in the future here.
Listen,
you never know.
Maybe, you know.
Again, during the 90s, I won't say it was the hardest time, but it was more difficult to do the Celtics, obviously, than it has been the last 5 years and was in the 80s when they were struggling. And so we were always looking for something to be positive about. And Tommy's always been very good at coming up with ideas and ways to raise the emotional level of the broadcast. And Walter McCarty became that. He captured Tommy's imagination. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but captured your imagination by the way he played and by his enthusiasm for the game. And I think he was one of those guys who you and I got to know pretty well off the court and liked very much off the court. And to this day, Walter has already said he'd leave his assistant coaching job to take your place in the broadcast booth. So I Love Walter just became a great thing. And as much as it was a great thing that Tommy did in coming up with the I Love Walter, God Love Walter for providing the moments that you could say it. And he was great at providing big moments at a time when we were short of big moments.
Well, when a guy comes in to a basketball game like Walter would do, and I don't care what he did, I mean, he might get 20 points, but he injected energy. And if you're a coach, I looked for guys coming off the bench to do exactly what Walter would do. Now, people would say, "Well, he's doing this about this guy coming off the bench." Now, in my other broadcasting career with Bob Cousy, when I was doing the play-by-play, when I would start, that's where I kind of really started I Love Walter. Mm-hmm. It started out, and I'd say, "Cuz, I love Walter." You know, and he'd look at me because he's a basketball purist. And Walter, obviously, is not going into the Hall of Fame, but I liked what he was providing the team. So every time I'd say, "I love Walter," he would look at me like I was crazy. So finally, Walter, up in Toronto, throws in a shot, a three-pointer, at the buzzer to beat Toronto. And Cousy says, "I think I'm beginning to love Walter." And I said, "You cannot now join the Walter McCarty fan club. you have to write me a check if you're going to join the Walter McCarty fan club after all these weeks. I said, so don't give me that stuff now. I'm the only guy in Walter McCarty's fan club. So, I mean, I was doing it in a joking fashion. All of a sudden, they're getting emails over at the station. How do we join the Walter McCarty fan club? And so finally, we went on the air one night, and I said, look, only Koozie has to pay to join the Walter McCarty fan club. Everybody else that feels about Walter like I do, after each game, throw the window open and yell out at the top of your lungs, I love Walter. So I figured that's a fun thing.
Close
that's
one
a joke.
Yeah.
Close that one out. That'll be that. All of a sudden, emails coming in. Will you stop telling my kid to scream at the top of his lungs, I love Walter, after the games? So, I mean, how this thing developed, and I mean, we were seeing signs of Tommy points and I love Walter all over the...
Everywhere.
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 It's like it just caught on. Mm-hmm.
Once we got the ownership that we have right now, I think Tommy and I both knew we're going to see a winner again here. And probably see another championship again here by how committed they were, how they were there at every game. They were pulling for this team. They were making the right hires and Doc and Danny. They just were doing all the right things. So it was a long march through the early 90s. But once we got this ownership in, there was reason for optimism. And they had a plan. They stuck to the plan. And when they used the chips that Danny had gathered to bring Kevin Garnett in, everything turned the corner. It was, I guess, I wasn't sure I was ever going to see it again. I was spoiled. You know, Tommy has 50 years, literally, with the Celtics of championships in numerous decades and in numerous roles. For me, I was lucky enough to be involved with a championship team right away in the first 4 or 5 years of my career. I didn't realize that I was going to have to go another 20 before I would see another one. So this was certainly much more sweeter from my point of view, to see the team come back the way it did and give us all a second life.
What really enthralled me was how they did it. When they played exactly with the same attitude of the teams that I played with. There was no guy bigger than winning. There was no reason that anybody was had to have his moment all the time, and we had to kowtow to that particular guy. They each one did what was necessary to be done to win, and that was the fun part, not only winning the championship but how well it was done, and they brought teamwork back into sports. For years the Celtics represented teamwork and a team, not individuals, and that's what that group did. And with Kevin and Pierce and Ray, they showed that teamwork is an important factor in doing anything correctly.
I think the thing that is, one of the things that's most impressive for me after, as to use his own words, that he's seen a million basketball games, is the enthusiasm that I know is going to be there every night. I can count on that. I can plan. I don't really plan ahead that much, to be honest with you, in terms of the broadcast. But I just know that's there. I don't have to worry about carrying him. I don't have to worry about him just fading out and disappearing. I know the enthusiasm for the game and for the moment is going to be there every night. And I also know that Tommy has always considered, and this has really helped me a lot, is that humor should be part of the game, that we should be having fun when we're broadcasting the game. That. You know, I like to think that on 4 or 5 occasions over the course of, if you're going to invest 2.5 hours or 2+ hours of watching us, we should reward you with about 3 or 4 laughs and make you feel good that many times during the course of the game. Tommy's a great guy. I've enjoyed being a straight man for 30 years. He's a great guy to work with.
Mike is a guy that, I mentioned it earlier, he's a team player. And for the benefit of the whole, I think both of us recognize that we do our thing. The fans are going to have a good time watching the game and enjoy it. And Mike doesn't have to be a star, doesn't want to be a star. He wants to do the games, and nobody does it better than him. He doesn't demand, like some play-by-play guys do, attention. And he lets the game breathe. And that's a tribute to Mike, so that the folks aren't constantly being bombarded by what he says, but by what they say.
Thanks for listening to Comcast SportsNet's Into the Archives. Check out csnne.com/podcast for upcoming episodes, plus info on how to subscribe on iTunes. Make sure to follow csnne.com on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at csnne. This is Kyle Draper, and thanks for listening.